You're listening to the MLB At The Plate podcast. We're giving you the best content from each episode of MLB At The Plate. MLB At The Plate airs weekdays from 7 p.m. to midnight Eastern time on TuneIn.
Welcome into the MLB At The Plate podcast. I'm Paul Severino today, joined by Ned Coletti. Today we're going to start the podcast out with MLB At The Plate Triple Play, which is where Ned and I discuss three topics that interest us. Tonight our Triple Play consists of discussions involving the crosstown trade of Jose Quintana from the White Sox to the Cubs, the Nats bolstering their bullpen with Madsen and Doolittle, and a one-time-only edition, it was that special, of Ned's Numbers.
The MLB At The Plate Triple Play.
Cubs, of course, made a big deal, one of the biggest, certainly the biggest to this point, but perhaps one of the biggest we will see in this trade deadline season, acquiring Jose Quintana on Thursday morning of the All-Star break. He goes out and pitches Sunday against Baltimore in his Cubs debut. Seven amazing innings, scoreless baseball, 12 strikeouts, a season high in strikeouts, one shy of a career high in strikeouts. The Chicago Cubs are a team we have been waiting, maybe giving them the benefit of the doubt, at least I know I did, that, you know what, they're going to turn it around. They'll figure this out. They'll get back on track. As a GM, when you make that move, you know your team's right there, you make that move, what does that do for the mojo of the clubhouse?
Well, I think it does a lot of good things for it. When you think about, I think this trade really, one of those trades that really helped both teams. From the White Sox perspective, you're going to make a trade with the Cubs. You're always going to make a trade if you can make your team better, but you're not going to make a trade with the crosstown rival, especially in that rivalry, just to do it. They give up a pitcher that's going to be under control through 2020, one of the, probably the best starting pitcher, I would guess, who will be traded this deadline. So they had a lot. They had currency to move, and the Cubs went. The Cubs gave up their top two prospects in order to get Quintana. But when you do that, you are telling your big league club, hey, we believe in you. We're going to give up some of the future. We've got a young team. We've got a world championship team. We're going to give up some of the future. We're not going to worry about that. We're going to add to this group because we do think the division is winnable. And who knows, maybe the entire thing one more time. They win tonight, and they're only up 2-1. They win tonight, coupled with the Milwaukee loss. Suddenly, it's a little bit different. Milwaukee, nobody expected them to be where they're at. So they may be a little bit on borrowed time. They've had a great run here through the first 80 or 94 games of their season, 95 games of their season after tonight. But they're going to have, I think they're going to have their hands full with the Cubs, who's starting to get out of their slumber a little bit.
It's amazing. I mean, you can ask around, and obviously I would defer to you as to whether or not Jose Quintana is an ace, but the value certainly goes up when he's pitching as well as he had been leading up to the start yesterday, and he was obviously great in his Cubs debut. But you pair that with how much he's making relative to other good pitchers, good frontline type starting pitchers. He's making $6 million this year, so the Cubs obviously won't owe him all of that, but $8.35 next year, a $10.5 million club option for 2019, and the same thing, $10.5 million club option for 2020 with buyouts each of those last 2 years. I mean, you talk about, you know, controllable players, left-handed starters. The Cubs have a fair share of young position players. So now, again, once you look at the 30,000-foot view of the Chicago Cubs, with Arrieta perhaps gone, with Lackey perhaps gone, with Lester only going to be a year older next year, not even just 2017, and they certainly have hopes of repeating and doing what they did last year, but you look into the next few years of the Chicago Cubs, and this is about as smart as a deal as they could make.
I agree. I think when you look at the relative choices that were out there, we have a chance to get somebody like Quintana. Is he an ace? I wouldn't necessarily call him an ace, but you know what? He's good enough to start a playoff game for you. I know that. And as you say, you've got two pitchers on their free agent walk here. You don't know what you're going to do with them. You've maybe have conversations with them, so you've got a little bit of a feel for what it's going to cost, and you got a very good feel for who they are and how well they compete and things like that, whether or not you want to do it. I think it's a very wise move by one of the smartest guys I know in the game, and Theo, and Jed Hoyer as well. Great move for them. They paid to do it. Whenever you make a deal and just you're not in the on the 30th or the 31st of July, you are going to pay a premium to do something that early But that's what they did. They had to get moving here. They had to get going before they got into another 10, 12 days from now. They need to win as many games as possible, as soon as possible. They told that entire clubhouse, hey, we believe in you. We mean business. Let's go. You guys pick it up from here.
And from a White Sox perspective, I think that Kenny Williams and Rick Hahn deserve an awful lot of credit, too, not just for this deal, but the last few deals that they have made. I mean, you talk about fortifying a farm system, and everybody's going to have their different rankings on the individual players, and that is what it is. But generally speaking, they have flown up the charts in terms of overall farm system rankings and how strong they are and how deep they are. And again, now, all of these trades that they made, are all of these guys going to hit and be superstars? Who knows? But what they've really done in my eyes, and again, I'll defer to you, is really increase the size of that target, really, in terms of acquiring a lot of high-end prospects and the odds of these guys, especially in this day and age where it seems like we seem to miss less and less in terms of big-time prospects panning out. Whatever sort of rebuild they're doing in Chicago, you know, it could happen really quick with this team if enough of these guys hit and hit rather quickly.
Agreed. I think they have a chance to be, maybe they're the Houston Astros. Maybe they're going to be that type of club, or maybe they're going to be the Cubs, that type of club that they go through a long period of time or relatively, I mean, it seems like forever when it's 2 or 3 or 4 years. You go through that growing pains and you wait and you're patient. Again, I use the word patience, tough to have in pro sports, tough to have in a major market, but it always pays a dividend for you if you can exhibit it. I think that the White Sox are on their way to being a very good team, maybe one of the best teams that they've had since they won the World Series back in 2005. Takes some time, no doubt, and it's going to take a lot of great player development. This is where your staff really comes in handy, and your scouts came in handy to help you figure out who you're going to go to, whether you're going to give up Quintana or you're going to give up Chris Sale, as they did back in December. Use that information, but then you got to develop, and you got to develop them in the culture that is a successful culture. Two good baseball men there in Kenny and Rick. So they, I think they're going to be very good here, not too distant future.
And they might not be done yet, too, because, right. You know, the more and more you read and hear about it, the guy like Todd Frazier could be out there. David Robertson. Now, granted, the obvious rumor for David Robertson has been Washington, D.C., and who's to say if that doesn't still happen at some point. But obviously the Washington Nationals have somewhat cleared up their bullpen issues with the Sean Doolittle and Ryan Madsen trade, and we'll talk about that in just a bit. But, you know, they could be bringing more back. Now, is Todd Frazier going to bring back the same haul as an Adam Eaton? Probably not, right? I mean, is David Robertson or Melky Cabrera going to bring back that same kind of a haul? I doubt it. But the bottom line is maybe they get, and you'd know better than I, but maybe you get some of those major league ready type pieces. Who knows? Maybe it's not a prospect, but somebody that can help you. And I guess in what I'm thinking is kind of how the Yankees did it last year. Like get some guys back that can help you now and in the future, as opposed to the prospect who is maybe more so just the future.
Yep. And there's value. There's value to Frazier, especially if somebody gets hurt from a contending team between now and the 31st of July. There's value certainly to Robertson. No doubt. There's teams that need that. You saw how bullpens were managed last year in the postseason. Cleveland, Andrew Miller. How big was Andrew Miller for the Cleveland Indians, even though they had Cody Allen? Huge acquisition for them. So there's a lot of different things that the White Sox can still do. They started at the top with maybe the ace of anybody that does get traded this year. And we can get into Washington here in a minute. But I think they did well. And I think that they're going to continue to add to that group, because talent also does something else. It breeds competition. And when you do not have a good team and your farm system is not good, that is a bad combination. You could have a struggling major league team, but if your farm system is starting to cook and you've got competition, those young players will compete. They may be best friends with the guys around them, but they're going to compete to get that shot at the big leagues.
And the Nationals have had a rough time with their bullpen this season. That is clearly well documented. There's no doubt about that. But on Sunday, they addressed that in a pair of ways by going to the Oakland A's and getting a lefty reliever and a righty reliever in Sean Doolittle and Ryan Madsen, and combo that with the fact that both of these guys at some points in their career have gotten the last three outs of a baseball game. Ned, I don't know where you stand on the ninth inning still meaning something or not, but to me, getting those last three outs is a different bird, and to have two guys with that ninth inning experience will only help whatever decision Dusty Baker needs to make.
Well, I think it's a very smart move by Mike Rizzo, and here's the reason I think so. Washington has lost six games this year in the ninth inning with leads. Dodgers, Houston have not lost one game with a ninth inning lead. You got Washington has got a great offense. You've got four guys that are really killing it offensively, and you've got seven relievers that have registered at least a save in that bullpen. So it has been an issue. Highest ERA, I think, in the National League, maybe in baseball, out of the pen. You've got two guys that have closed, two guys that are experienced. I don't know that it'll be the last trade Rizzo makes to help his bullpen. I do believe it was smart and it was shrewd. So if this is the last trade, because the closers may wait, I think they still need a closer. And neither one of these guys was closing for Oakland, and Oakland is eight games under, I think, coming into tonight. So they weren't closing for Oakland. Can they close? Maybe. Have they closed? Yeah, they have. Are they going to close in a type of series that Washington really needs to win? They've had a really good team there for a while. Postseason has not been their cup of tea. I think it protects their bullpen. It gives Dusty a couple more options, and it also gives you somebody that can maybe pitch the seventh and eighth inning and really be effective at it if you can get a closer out of Chicago, out of the rival down in Baltimore, if you're up in Baltimore, if you can do that type of thing. But not knowing, and something that gets lost in the shuffle all the time in negotiations or trade negotiations, is timing. And timing is a part of the game that people sometimes forget about. But when you have a chance to make a deal and you know your bullpen needs help, and Mike Rizzo looks around and says, hey, I got a chance to get two guys that have closed. They may be the best I can do right now. Let's go get them. You have to do that. So I applaud his move there. I think it strengthens the bullpen. Is it the last move? Would it be my last move? Well, if I had a chance at Robertson or Britton or somebody else that you know is a bona fide big league closer, I would probably add that to the shopping list between now and the 31st of July.
Here's another thing, and you make great points. Another thing to me that makes a lot of sense is not only are you helping your bullpen, but you're really helping your starting pitching too. Because looking at it right now, entering today, the Washington Nationals, the most innings pitched by 13 innings over any other starting rotation in baseball. And this is Steven Strasburg, who is healthy now but has had an injury history. Max Scherzer, who has been nothing but a workhorse in his career. Joe Ross is already going under the knife. His season's done. Tanner Roark hasn't been at his best in 2017. And Gio Gonzalez has been pretty darn good this season. So that's pretty much your five starting pitchers, mixing in a couple of guys here and there. But that's a lot of innings from the starting pitchers. So if you're Mike Rizzo and you're that front office and you can figure out a way to shorten games, even though you've got a terrific starting rotation, but take some of the heat off of those guys who, once you get to the postseason, you plan on leaning on quite a bit. I think that also helps, too, because, at the start of play, they have a 9.5-game lead. So unless they're playing for seeding, and one can imagine they will be at some point, but unless they're doing that, there's going to be a point in time where they're able to kind of take their foot off the gas a little bit, and obviously you don't want to do it too much. But I think that figuring out a way to give their starting rotation a little bit of a breather, a little bit of a blow here or there, I think that can also be, as much as the seventh, eighth, and ninth innings have been issues for them, help the starting rotation to not feel like they've got to go out there and throw eight every day.
Great point. Great point, because as you get going, as you start to get into the August part of your schedule and September, you've still got 10 weeks to play. Those innings do pile up, and I don't care who you are. The innings in October are different. There's a different stress level. There's a different fatigue level that comes in no matter how much you desire it and how bad you want to be there. Sometimes it takes, you've already had a little bit more than you wish taken out of you in the course of a season. I think it helps their bullpen a lot. I think it helps their rotation, as you said. I think it puts them in a much better place. It's a safe bet. It's a certainly an early move, and I think it's a safe bet to continue to shore it up, and your point is well taken, because those guys, pitching is going to win a postseason. Let's face it. That's how it goes. They've got four great hitters at the top of, in that order that play out there every day. A lot of RBIs, a lot of run production, big-time batting averages. Offense is not a question for Washington. The guys you mentioned as starting pitching, not a question. Keeping them healthy, keeping them sharp, that's something that everybody's got to work on. And in the meantime, now you've added two guys, one right-hander, one left-hander, and Doolittle's been tremendous against left-handed hitting. I think that it's a huge thing to be able to get that now and continue to work to see if you can add one more piece to that bullpen.
Yeah, and obviously with Trinan going to Oakland, they essentially, obviously just based on sheer numbers, they only added one bullpen arm when you think about it, because they traded away Trinan, who's been a big part of that bullpen too. But again, whatever the case may be, it'll be something to follow in these next couple of weeks as to whether or not the Washington Nationals add even more aside from Ryan Madsen and Sean Doolittle from the Oakland A's. What we have seen with all of the Sabre metrics is the three true outcomes, as we always hear: the home run, the walk, and the strikeout. And Ned, I know that you looked at some numbers for the first half of the season and kind of where we're at. It's an unsponsored segment, Ned's numbers, but I'm making a pitch for it right now. What were you able to cook up?
Well, I didn't make these up, and I actually read them, so there's other people who should get credit for this. But as you say, there's the three outcomes: the strikeout, the walk, the home run. The sixth highest strikeout totals in Major League Baseball at the All-Star break have come in the last 6 years. So in other words, the strikeout, which used to be something nobody wanted to be associated with, is no longer viewed as a big deal. We've already talked about home runs. 3,343 were hit before the break. That's the most all time. So it's swing hard in case you hit it. A little side note to that, back in during World War II, 1943, if you can believe this, 407 home runs were hit that year. That's just a little side note. Obviously, 3,000 is really where it's been for a while. The 411 triples were hit before the break, the lowest total since 95. Starting pitchers shows you the value of bullpen, but shows you also that the endurance isn't there anymore. You can watch teams play, especially in the National League, which I see games all the time. There's just a lack of pitching. Starting pitchers are averaging 5.5 innings per start. That is the lowest total in history. 37 complete games thrown before the break, lowest total in history. 17 complete game shutouts, lowest total in history. Previous lows were 43 versus 37, 20 versus 17, and the 20 came last year. Sacrifice bunts, nobody does that anymore. All-Star games started in 1933. Fewest sacrifice bunts in the history of baseball up to the break, 517. And one last thing, 1960 World Series. Yankees, Pirates, Game 7, historic game. Bill Mazeroski, walk-off home run. The Pirates upset the great Yankee teams, the teams with Maris, who would hit 61 home runs the next year, Mickey Mantle, great, great teams, 11-10. You know how many strikeouts are in that game? I already gave you the answer a few hours ago. There were zero. No strikeouts in the game. And a 21-run game, World Series, Game 7, was played in 2 hours and 36 minutes.
Unbelievable.
Major differences in the game as you go through it. I know that was a long time ago now, but still, it's, you know, some of the foundations of the game are never going to change. Strike out a lot. Right now, it's if you just produce runs, hit home runs. We talked about leadoff men, some really good ones like Blackman. A lot of home runs already, really a great, great player. But it's not the prototypical stolen base, get on base, work a count, see what you can do, try and get on base, get moved over to second base, get them over, get them in, all that stuff. That's all gone. Maybe in a tie game late, you know, you're going to try and win a game that way. But it's such a different game. And the strikeouts doesn't make any difference. Starting pitching, you get five innings out of a guy, it's almost time to have a parade. It doesn't, you know, they talk about records that'll never be broken. Ripken, that consecutive game record, that'll never be broken. Nobody, it's tough to get a guy to play 162 games. That'll never go away. But also, you look back at the even in the 70s and the guys in the 60s like Koufax and Bob Gibson and Drysdale and Ferguson Jenkins and Tom Seaver, look at their complete game totals. They're in the 30s-some years, 300-plus innings. Guess what? Nobody's throwing 300 innings ever again, and you'll find divisions in baseball, divisions, that won't have as many complete games as one man had 40 years ago.
I'm looking at it right now. There are 30 pitchers who have thrown a complete game this year, and Ervin Santana's thrown 4, Max Scherzer 2, Kluber 2, Nova 2, Stroman 2. The other, 25 guys have thrown 1. And if I just look at the league leaders here, innings pitched per game started, there are 3 pitchers with an average of 7 or more innings per start. And it's Max Scherzer, Chris Sale, and Clayton Kershaw. And I'm looking at Baseball Reference, and, you know, they obviously, because of the thirds of an inning, the numbers are a bit skewed here. So they've got Michael Fulmer at 6.9 and Dallas Keuchel at 6.9. So you've got some guys kind of on the brink of averaging 7 innings per start. But, you know, from a GM's perspective, that's really an interesting thing, because we talked about it with the Washington Nationals, and you help your bullpen not even to shorten the game, just in terms of the way that the game is played now and throwing, you know, max effort guys out there and different looks for the last 3 innings of a game, but also from a starting pitcher perspective, in terms of knowing that these guys are not going to throw 300 innings. Very few guys throw 250 innings, for goodness sakes, anymore.
Oh, goodness. You'll have to pitch deep into October to get a guy with 250 innings.
Yeah.
Your Verlanders, your Matt Cain,
right?
Yeah. Guys like that, Kluber. You know, you're talking about playing three playoff series and probably making yourselves another six starts, maybe 7 starts in that period of time in order to get to that 250 mark.
Right. And again, I don't fault these guys, because I still think that they're in unbelievable shape. And it's just a guy who's, you know, made the headlines himself. But, you know, fewer pitchers are in better shape than Jake Arrieta. And here's a guy who was an absolute workhorse and put up ungodly numbers a few years back. And even he's talked about that heavy workload 1 year and still kind of having the residual effects and maybe playing into his coming back down to earth, in a sense. And that's what's amazing. But, you know, all these guys, or a good chunk of these guys, they would look great with their shirt off. I didn't think I'd say that on tonight's program, but they'd look great with their shirt off. But it's a matter of, like, you know, being in baseball shape and being in, you know, cover of muscle and fitness shape.
It's two different dynamics, you know. As I used to go to ballpark when I was a kid really early, because you'd get in at 10 o'clock at Wrigley Field, 10:15. You could get there so early, nobody would be on the field yet. Batting practice hadn't started. Nothing had really transpired. Pitchers would run. They would run every day. You had a coach, the pitching coach for the Cubs back in the late 60s, early 70s, was a guy named Joe Becker. Joe Becker would stand in the well at Wrigley Field, like where the outfield wall kind of curves in left field, with a fungo bat, and his 8 or 9 pitchers, and they didn't have staffs of 12 or 13, still had 25 men on the roster. They had more position players than they had pitchers by far. And he would hit fungos to everybody but the starting pitcher, and they would run to the right field corner. This went on day after day after day. And when you look at old film, guys were tall. They were lanky almost. And now you look at guys, and they're bulked up. And you go to showcases, you go to tournaments for high school kids, and everybody's trying to throw as hard as they can throw, because that's how they think they're going to get signed. And that's how they're going to get a great signing bonus at 18 years old and all of that. And, hey, everybody, you wish everybody the best of life and the best that you could ever do. But there's a difference in the bodies of those who used to pitch 250, 275, 300 innings, and what you see today. And it's so interesting, because almost every player, almost everyone, will take a month off when the season's over and then start working out. And look at the DL lists. Look at the number of days teams lose through DL. Years ago, guys used to go to work in the off season. Maybe they were a carpenter. Maybe they worked at a car dealer. But they had to supplement their income by going to work, and then they would make 30, 35 starts and pitch 250 innings or have 700 plate appearances and miss very few innings. Now, look at the DL list. It's rare that a day goes by that somebody of some prominence doesn't go across the bottom line on one of the TV shows has been placed on the DL. It's unbelievable.
I always try to liken it to kind of like my own life, right? And if I want to get better at being a studio host, or if I want to get better being on the radio, or I want to get better doing play-by-play, yes, I would watch my own game film and listen to myself, but I would also ask the guys who do it better than I do.
Yep.
And I wonder why more pitchers, and maybe they do, this is an outsider throwing this out there, but I wonder why some of the pitchers nowadays don't rack the brains of older pitchers or pitchers who have been more, shall I say, durable in their career. I mean, I did the World Baseball Classic, the international feed in San Diego and L.A. with Jim Cott. I mean, this guy pitched for 25 years.
Oh, yeah.
Now, granted, it's a different game now than it is then. I understand that. But that was a guy who basically threw every single day. And you hear it so much that the guys, the pitchers, if pitchers did, quote unquote, prehab for Tommy John surgery before they had the injury and they strengthened the ligaments and the muscles and all that stuff in their elbow before they needed Tommy John surgery, they wouldn't need Tommy John surgery. And now it's just like, you know, we throw Tommy John around like it's a Tic Tac and everybody's going to have it and everybody's going to be back in 12 to 15 months and everybody's going to be just as good, if not better. Okay, that might be the case for the major leaguer, but for that high school player, that college player, that, you know, middle of the road minor leaguer who can't lose a year and a half of his baseball career at that point in time. To me, that would be problematic.
Oh yeah, it's such a different look. A good friend of mine is been with the San Francisco Giants for a long time now. When I was with Chicago early in my career with the Cubs, he was a relief pitcher. Dick Tidrow is his name. Mm-hmm. Dick Tidrow was a rookie in 1972 at Cleveland, 237 innings. 1973, 274 innings. 74, 209 innings. Okay. Think about the workload there. And he used to tell me that one of his coaches was Johnny Sain. And you've heard the old story, you know, spawn and Sain and pray for rain, right? Sain used to tell him that him and Warren Spahn, every day they would do something that was what a pitcher would do. They would go out early and throw BP to each other on days they weren't pitching. They always threw. They always ran. They kept their core strong. Talking about two of the better pitchers in the game, Warren Spahn, arguably one of the top two or three left-handed pitchers of all time, and they worked at it every day. And I don't know if you ever had a chance to meet Warren Spahn. Warren Spahn was not a big man. He was not tall. He was not robust. He was a shorter man that was a tremendous pitcher. I mean, tremendous. Look, you're listening out there, look him up one day and look at the years he had and look at how long he pitched. This man pitched well into his late 30s. He may have touched 40 and maybe threw a no-hitter near the very end of his career. But it's a different way of looking at it. It's a different way that people train, and it's changed the game dramatically. There's a lot of changes in the game. That's one of the major ones for me.
Yeah. There's no question about it. It's a fun discussion to have, and unfortunately, with the elbow injuries, there's no answer to it as of yet.
You're listening to the MLB At The Plate podcast, and we'll be right back with more after this.
The 11th Hour with Brian Williams. Tomorrow's headlines before they go to print.
I've just been handed some great reporting.
Tomorrow's questions before anyone's asked them.
Could you make an obstruction case?
Tomorrow's conversation tonight.
Who is there to stand up to the boss and speak truth to power?
Not a single person.
The 11th Hour with Brian Williams. More than the day that was, it's the day that will be. Weeknights at 11 Eastern on MSNBC.
Between game-winning drives and walk-off home runs, follow TuneIn Sports on social media and get the latest scoop on our great sports shows. From MLB at the Plate to NFL No Huddle, be the first to know about upcoming interviews with some of the biggest stars in sports. or check out behind-the-scenes coverage that you can't get anywhere else. Like us at TuneIn Sports on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and keep up on all the latest news and happenings from around the world of sports.
This is the MLB At The Plate podcast. Here are your hosts, Paul Severino and Ned Coletti.
There were 13 games on the Monday schedule, and to bring you up to speed on all the action, we've got the best day ever, home run tracker, and statistically speaking.
Best day ever on MLB At The Plate.
All right, so who had a really good day today? We had 13 games to choose from, and like I said, still got a bunch of games in progress. But, Ned, your pitcher, who had the best day ever?
Well, maybe not his best day ever, but it's certainly close, especially when you think about the years he had in Detroit thus far since signing a big deal. And that's Jordan Zimmermann. 6 2/3 innings, he's in line for the W, 7 hits, 1 earned run. No walks, 7 Ks. This is the pitcher that Detroit thought they were signing when they gave him 5 years and $110 million a few years ago.
Yeah, another guy who got a big-time deal who left Washington, D.C. was, Jordan Zimmermann's the guy who left Washington, D.C., but his former rotation mate, Steven Strasburg, is my guy. 11 strikeouts in 7 innings, fairly efficient along the way with 105 pitches. 6th time this season that he's gone for 10 or more strikeouts. And Strasburg, despite the fact that his last time out left with that injury after getting banged up, he looked to be back on track as the Nationals stay hot. On the position player, hitter side of things, Ned, who's your guy?
I'm going to go with Mr. Stanton out of Miami. Had his 3rd multi-home run game in his last 9, hit number 27 and 28. A couple home runs, 3 RBIs, and also in his attempt to have his first 3 home run game, hit one to deep center field in Miami, up against the wall. So big night there for Mr. Stanton.
Yeah, he's fun to watch on any given night. It looks like he could just tee off on someone in more of a golf sense, that is. My guy is Ryan Zimmermann, 3 for 5 today with a home run. But the home run was something of a milestone, as he is now the franchise leader for the Washington Nationals Montreal Expos franchise. The all-time home run leader for them as he passed Vlad Guerrero earlier today with the home run, again, as the Washington Nationals win their 5th straight and overall their 56th victory of the season. So that's the best day ever. We've also had a lot of home runs in this 13-game schedule. It's time for the Home Run Tracker.
MLB At The Plate Home Run Tracker.
A lot of home runs to choose from. Let's begin with the finals and the Washington Nationals with a 6-1 win on the Reds. Told you about Zimmermann, his 20th. Harper hit his 23rd. Brian Goodwin hit his 8th. For the Cincinnati Reds, it was Eugenio Suarez with his 13th home run of the season in a 6-1 defeat. Pirates and the Milwaukee Brewers, no home runs on either side for those two teams. For the Texas Rangers and Baltimore Orioles, Seth Smith hit his 10th home run of the season. That came in the 7th inning off of Andrew Kashner. The Marlins, as we mentioned, 2 home runs from Giancarlo Stanton. He now has 28 on the season. And Justin Bour with another majestic blast, his 21st. No home runs on the Phillies side of things. It's an extra inning win for the Marlins, 6-5. For the St. Louis Cardinals, they got a home run from Paul DeJong, his 10th. Tommy Pham, his 12th, and the New York Mets, a home run from Michael Conforto, rather, his 16th home run of the season, and Lucas Duda, also number 16. Toronto Blue Jays, a 4-3 win over the Boston Red Sox. Steve Pierce connected on home run number 8, and nothing left the yard for the Boston Red Sox at Fenway Park. Again, a 4-3 defeat. Minnesota Twins doubled up the Yankees today, 4-2, the final score there. No home runs at Target Field tonight, so not too many to go around. We still have a bunch of games in progress, too. Let's run through those. Anthony Rizzo with his 23rd home run, as it's currently a 4-3 lead for the Chicago Cubs on the Braves. That's in the bottom of the 9th. On the Braves side of things, nothing in the home run column to date, but again, they're batting in the bottom of the 9th. For the Mariners, a home run from Nelson Cruz, his 20th, Mike Zunino, his 13th, Kyle Seager, his 13th as well, Jake Mariznick, home run number 11, Carlos Beltran, home run number 12. 10-2, it is now a final in Kansas City, as the Detroit Tigers beat up on the Kansas City Royals. Nicholas Castellanos, number 12. Mikey Matsuk, number 5. And a home run in a losing effort for Eric Hosmer, his 13th. back and forth affair, as they usually are in Colorado. Jabari Blash, his third home run. Hector Sanchez, his sixth. But it is currently a 9-6 Rockies lead in that one. Charlie Blackmon helping to pace the Rockies at the moment. 22nd home run for him, and Gerardo Parra with his eighth. They are into the sixth inning right now, the bottom of the sixth inning in Oakland. Rays have gotten home runs from Steven Souza Jr., number 19, and Evan Longoria, number 14. Chris Davis with his 26th home run for the Oakland A's. In San Francisco, it's 4-3. Tribe on top of the San Francisco Giants. Yan Gomes, number 6, and no home runs thus far for the San Francisco Giants. Now, when it comes to the ones that really stand out, Giancarlo Stanton with the hardest home run of the night, his first of the night, was hit at 115 miles an hour off the bat. And the longest home run, Lucas Duda, 491 feet. My goodness, did he get all of that one. So that is your home run tracker on this Monday night. Some other things to keep an eye on, statistically speaking.
Statistically speaking.
So this is where we go around and have some fun notes to pass along. There are only four active players who hold their franchise home run record, and that is Ryan Braun with the Brewers at 296, Evan Longoria with the Tampa Bay Rays with 254, Giancarlo Stanton 235 with the Miami Marlins, and thanks to Ryan Zimmerman's home run today, 235 to lead the Nationals franchise again, passing Vlad Guerrero. Charlie Blackmon, 26 leadoff home runs over the last five seasons, four more than the next closest player in Major League Baseball. He is an awful lot of fun to watch. That's it for the MLB at the Plate podcast. Make sure to join us on MLB on TuneIn at 7 Eastern each weeknight for MLB at the Plate. During the daily five-hour show, not only are you going to hear all of what you heard in this podcast, but we'll also have the chance to listen to live games and get the action as it happens. For Abe and Tony in the LA studio and Ned Coletti, I'm Paul Severino, and we will catch you Tuesday.
Thank you for listening to the MLB at the Plate podcast. Catch us every weeknight on TuneIn, where we take you around Major League Baseball with live listenings, analysis, player interviews, and much more. Plus, be sure to check out our other great content on TuneIn, featuring the very best in sports, music, news, and talk. On TuneIn, get caught up in the moment with more than 100,000 music stations and 5 million podcasts from around the world. Exclusive sports content, including live MLB, NFL, NBA, and NHL games, and 24/7 news coverage from CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News Radio. Tune in, your everything audio app.